Still a disconnect for relief operations in the Philippines. Today, Wednesday, November 13th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Plane loads of aid supplies are landing in the devastated city of Tacloban, but that aid isn't flowing to most survivors. And Filipinos are wondering where their government officials are.
They've been filmed helping direct traffic, being very engaged, then flown out again, and then nothing. And I think that's been very, very dispiriting for people here.
We'll have details on the race to get food, water, and medical supplies to survivors. Also today, the quest to satisfy safety-conscious cyclists who refuse to wear a bike helmet.
They were all asking for something really discreet and something preferably invisible and something that would not destroy their personal style or their hair, for that matter.
And later, recycling cigarette butts in Vancouver.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Imagine you and your family are so hungry that you're willing to steal to feed them. Well, day six following Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, that's what many families are facing. But today there are reports of a full-scale aid effort finally taking shape. The devastated city of Tacloban is the nerve center for this just-ramping-up relief operation. The BBC's Jonathan Head spent the day in the city center and at the airport.
It's really been two stories today, a growing sense of panic and real fear among the population as they've gone for yet another day with almost no help at all that they've seen, getting desperately hungry, not finding enough water to drink, and really fearful. They've got no shelter, nowhere to live at all. At the same time, down at the airport, there were actually the first signs I've seen of a fully engaged international organized aid effort. The US Marine Force was there. They've been planning to come in, but we spoke to the Marine Force commander, Brigadier General Paul Kennedy. He brought in two of the Osprey heavy lift helicopter aircraft that they'll be using, and they'll be using a lot more of them for taking aid out to very remote areas that have not had anything so far. And they're promising to bring in very big C-17 transport aircraft. He was saying you will see a much bigger arrival of aid over the next 48 hours. And we saw UN aid, large amounts of it, finally being put onto Philippine military trucks and taken into town where it was going to be distributed. I mean, it's the first sign where there's been a well enough organized and guarded distribution of aid that the agencies have felt they can actually get it going. Up to now, there's been so much chaos in the city, so little evidence of the authorities, and really, you know, quite near anarchy. I mean, people are so hungry. They've been just looting places that none of the agencies have wanted to take aid in because they said it would just be taken straight away.
Jonathan, there was that rush of people on a rice warehouse outside Tacloban. Tell us what happened there, because that really seems to kind of exemplify why people are so panicky and fearful right now.
We've seen a lot of cases where people are lining up initially orderly. I mean, people are inclined to be orderly here, but then it breaks down, particularly if they're really hungry and they see that the guards aren't very strong or they're not there. And often these lines outside food warehouses degenerate because there's not enough. And people at the back of the line know they're not going to get any. In this case, in a town just outside Tacloban, the rush on the rice warehouse became such a mob that a wall collapsed and eight people were killed. And it's an example of how fragile the situation is here. I found it very interesting that, you know, given how desperate people's position is, that their biggest fear is the collapse of law and order. There are rumors of women being raped. We've got no confirmation of that. But if you're a family with young women you've got no home, you've got no walls, and there's this kind of sense of desperate, wild people wandering around and very little police or army presence, you can see where the fear comes from. So it's a very dangerous atmosphere. And I think it's probably one of the biggest questions about the response of the Philippine authorities. This was a massive disaster. Any government would have been stretched to start getting aid coming through quickly. But you would have expected in a country with a big armed forces and a big police force for an attempt to establish law and order, to start clearing roads much sooner than the significant efforts we're just beginning to see today.
Have you spoken with people who are leaving, and what have they told you that their reasons are for leaving?
It's hard to get across to you how utterly destroyed this town is. I can't imagine how quickly they'll fix it. But if you're here and you just lost everything and you looked out at this wasteland, it looks like it's been hit by an atomic bomb. You know, and there's just this mass of sodden rubble that was people's homes, covering everything with splintered trees. It's uninhabitable. And I can understand, for their point of view, they just say there's nothing left. They are utterly distraught and they feel they just can't stay here. I think for others, it is pure fear, on particularly with food. Most of Tacloban citizens are stuck here, and their desperation is what's dangerous, because they're stuck in a place where up to now the government's presence has been minimal. They've heard nothing from them and they've had no sense that they're going to be helped. I think that will change in the next 24 hours with the ramping up of this aid effort. But it really has to happen quickly if they're not going to see a serious degeneration of law and order.
Why has this rescue effort been so slow to get going, Jonathan?
Any disaster on this size is not going to come quickly. I mean, I've covered others, I think, of the Pakistan earthquake in 2005, the Asian tsunami in 2004, all of these things. When it's on this scale where everything is gone, it's very hard to know where to start. And you add to that a government in the Philippines that is not particularly well known for either efficiency. It's quite corrupt. There are political battles that go on too. I think there was probably some panic. And when you lose all the local authorities, you know, the central government wasn't geared up to come in and start sorting things out very fast here. In my experience, in a disaster of this scale, you won't see anything significant for about 4 days. But by the fourth or fifth day, there should at least be signs that something's happening and messages going out. And that's what's been missing here. Any sense of engagement from the government. There have been high-profile visits. The president came very, very quickly after the disaster. Other senior ministers have been in. You know, they've been filmed, helping direct traffic, being very engaged, then flown out again, and then nothing. And I think that's been very, very dispiriting for people here, that sense of a total absence of the central government's presence. It probably will change, but I think there's going to be a great deal of criticism of its response.
Personally, Jonathan, what's it been like for you? You're kitted out, I assume, and yet you're surrounded by people who have nothing.
That's always hard. I mean, I tell you, at the airport today, I met many, many families who'd walked long distances. They had very young children. They all wanted water. They didn't have any drinking water. It was very, very hot. And we have water. We need water. We can't work if we don't have it as well. And we had to get our water into the airport and we had to smuggle it inside a bag because we knew that if they saw it, they would just mob us. And yet, you know, it was going out and finding families and handing them bottles of water quietly so that other people didn't see. It feels such a futile gesture, really. I mean, so many other people I've met, and, you know, Filipino people have a tremendous resilience and a great positive spirit. It's incredible to meet people who are willing to see the bright side that they survive, even though they've lost everything. But, you know, the tears come pretty quickly, and it's the children as well. You see so many children, you know, in this ghastly mess with nothing coming into them, and you just want to hug them, and you wish you could do more. As a journalist, you do your job, which is to report and hope that other people respond, but you do often feel really, really helpless.
That was the BBC's Jonathan Head in the city of Tacloban. Joining me now here in the studio is The World's Jason Margolis. Jason, you spent a couple of weeks in the Philippines a few years ago reporting on an oil spill that impacted the same area where the typhoon hit, right?
Yeah, so I was about 280 miles to the west of Tacloban on a few islands that are part of what's called the Visayas region. Just beautiful, beautiful islands, without question, one of the most incredible places I've ever been on this planet.
And remind us a bit about the geography of the Philippines.
So the Philippines is an archipelago. It's 7,107 islands. And all told, the landmass equals a little bit more than the state of Arizona. So as you can imagine, thousands of these islands are really tiny. I stayed on one called Nagarao, which you could walk the entire perimeter in about a half hour. And these islands are home to fishermen. They live right on the shore. It's been that way for generations and generations. Those islands were hit by the typhoon. Hundreds of people are reported dead, and it's likely thousands are suffering. We just don't know how many have been impacted because it's hard to reach these places.
So thousands of islands, most of them have no bridges or connected to each other. So what are these infrastructural challenges that the Philippines faces getting food to those people? I mean, what was it like where you were?
Well, okay, so let me explain how I got to Nagaro, that tiny island where you could walk the perimeter in a half hour. So I flew into Manila from the United States on a big plane. Then I got on a smaller plane and went to the city of Iloilo. From there, I got on a ferry and went to another island and got on a jeep and drove across that island for about a half day on these unpaved roads. From there, I got off the jeep and got on an outrigger canoe. All told, that was about 3 days to reach my destination. So that was during good times, and you can imagine how difficult it would be with these roads and bridges probably destroyed, and they're carrying massive amounts of food and medical supplies and other necessities.
And that's pretty much typical anywhere in the Philippines. I've spoken with Peace Corps volunteers who've served there. It's all about those motorized outrigger canoes. What are the roads like in the Philippines?
Well, according to the CIA's World Factbook, about 25% of the roads in the Philippines are paved. That's a far lower number than surrounding countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Singapore. By comparison, in the United States, two-thirds of our roads are paved. And we also have highways. So you can think about a tragedy like Hurricane Katrina. You have paved roads and you have highways to get stuff in and out. And you don't have that in the Philippines.
Right.
Or to a lesser extent.
You've also been researching the airports in the Philippines as well.
Yes. So in order to get those big, wide planes that carry all the supplies, you need a long runway, basically 10,000 feet. The Philippines has four of those in the entire country. Again, by comparison, the U.S. has 189. Tacloban doesn't have one of those runways, so it can't get one of those long planes. So you can see you need to land the big plane in Manila, unpack it, put it on a smaller plane, and then get it where it needs to go. That takes time. It takes planning. It's a huge challenge.
The World's Jason Margolis, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Charmaine Clamore is from the Philippines. She's a jazz singer and now lives in Los Angeles. Charmaine, we've had you on the program before, but you were talking then about how the Philippines is embedded in your music. Now you're connected to something very sad, very unpleasant. How's this all affecting you personally?
Marco, it's devastating what's happening in the Philippines right now. And it's hard for me to sleep at night in my comfortable bed where I can turn on the air conditioning and control the heater when my kababayan or my brothers and sisters have nowhere to sleep or they can't find their family. It's heartbreaking to me. And I'm really grateful for my life, but, you know, it's heartbreaking, Marco.
Do you have family or friends who live in the affected areas?
I have close family, friends who are there, and some of our relatives already went home to make sure that they are found. Some people are missing in the remote areas. My immediate family are more north of Tacloban and you know, Bohol and Cebu were. The typhoon occurred.
How are they doing?
My family are doing well. You know, we get this every year, so we're used to a typhoon. But this one is just, it was unexpected how hard it was. And, you know, as you know, it's the hardest typhoon we've had in history. There's a sense of, oh, we can recover for this. But then there's a sense of desperation that it's going to take longer than usual.
You were talking about lying in your comfortable bed and how tough it is to process all this. Is it tough because you have lived through typhoons and know what this kind of devastation can mean? Or is it just tough because you're so far from home?
It's difficult to accept the fact that so many people are homeless. I guess it's an emotional cord that I have for my people. I just feel for them, for their loss and their sorrow.
Charmaine, you've been pretty adamant on Facebook since the weekend that people who want to donate to the relief effort be cautious before giving. Why is this an important message for you to get across?
Because the people, the victims of the typhoon, need the funding, and our government is corrupt. We have so many corruption there.
The Filipino government.
Yes, and I just want to make sure that the funds go directly to where it's needed and that it doesn't get diluted.
I mean, you're not even there, Charmaine. You're in Los Angeles, and yet I hear desperation in your voice.
Yes. A whole town has been wiped away. You know, they have not responded to the rural areas because it's been difficult because of transportation problem and communication. They don't have water. How long can a person go without water? They need help.
Jazz singer Charmaine Clamore from the Philippines, now living in Los Angeles. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The battle over gay rights in Russia is getting a lot of attention. That's because of the recently passed Russian law that bans so-called gay propaganda, and because gay rights activists are protesting that law ahead of the upcoming Winter Olympics in Sochi. But Russia isn't the only country in its neighborhood where homosexuality has become the focus of intense debate. Something similar is happening in other former Soviet nations. J. Lester Fader has been reporting in Ukraine as a foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed.
Well, we're seeing in Ukraine, as in a lot of other countries, an intense interest in the same kind of propaganda laws that were passed in Russia. And after that was passed, you saw an interest in that in other places, Ukraine being one of them. And we've seen now, as Ukraine moves towards signing an agreement to formalize its relationship with the European Union, a real intense interest both in that law and more broadly in using opposition to gay rights as a way to make an issue out of what association with the EU would mean.
And so why? I mean, does Russia lead all former Soviet republics on this issue of gay rights, or rather lack of gay rights?
I think we see throughout that part of the world a lot of homophobia on a cultural level. It's not like that was invented now, but it's become a very useful political issue. When Russia passed its propaganda law, it was using that in part to define itself in opposition to the West. And it was useful to Vladimir Putin as a way of defining a broader view of the world and in his domestic political context as well. But the anxiety over relationships with the West is something that is playing out throughout Eastern Europe as the EU continues to expand towards Russia, and as Russia is fighting very hard to hold on to its influence in this part of the world.
So there's one group kind of comes across as a slightly Anita Bryant-esque organization called Ukrainian Choice. Is it a homophobic organization, or are they kind of a proxy of Vladimir Putin?
So Ukrainian Choice is a broader organization than just dealing with gay rights. They were organized to more broadly oppose affiliation with the European Union and instead advocating aligning more forcefully with Russia. It has become a hub of promoting this kind of homophobia because this issue is one that they feel like they can rally people around. We've seen in Kiev now billboards going up that say things like, "The European Union means gay marriage," from Ukrainian Choice. It is funded by a former lawmaker and a wealthy businessman who does have very close personal ties to Putin.
So give us a picture, Lester, of what gay lesbian life is like in Ukraine in 2013.
We're still seeing in Ukraine, as in a lot of other parts of this area, a lot of violence, a lot of suppression of political rights. The first Pride parade happened in Kiev only after they defined a police ban and moved the location. We have seen a number of high-profile hate crimes. We're now seeing that organizations that have been operating in Russia, like Occupy Pedophilia being the most well-known of these, which sets up these sort of stings where they entrap gay men and then film videos humiliating them. They've been operating also in Ukraine. It's not a comfortable place to be. It's not by any stretch, I think, as bad as Russia has become, and in part because of the countervailing pressure from the European Union to ensure some level of gay rights. But on a cultural level and a political level, there's still a lot of suppression.
Compared to this story in other parts of the world and LGBT rights around the globe, what strikes you about Ukraine?
That you can't really talk about LGBT rights in isolation here. There is a much bigger geopolitical debate happening. You have real competition between two very large economic and political powers in the region. And this debate, how that works out in places like Ukraine, will be heavily shaped by those actors, by Russia and the EU, not necessarily by activists whose primary concerns are LGBT rights.
J. Lester Fader, a foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed, and 2013 Alicia Patterson Journalism Fellow. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Take a look at your bookshelf. How many books by non-English language authors? British writer and journalist Anne Morgan put her bookshelves to the test a couple of years ago.
All the books on the bookshelves were by British or American writers. There really wasn't anything much else.
And that's when she decided to read one book from every nation in the world over a one-year period, which she did. 197 books in all from as many independent countries and territories. We asked Morgan to tell us how she did it. She says she realized early on that she'd need help.
So in late 2011, I registered the domain name ayearofreadingtheworld.com, and I wrote a very short piece asking the world's readers to help me find books, to tell me what I should be reading from their part of the world, or if there were any books that they had read that they particularly enjoyed. I didn't know what sort of response I was going to get. Maybe I would be on my own with this. Within 4 days of me launching the blog, I got a message from a woman called Rafida in Kuala Lumpur. And she said, I love your project. I love the idea of what you're trying to do. And I'd like to go to a bookshop in Kuala Lumpur and choose you a book and post it to you to read as your choice from Malaysia. There were people who went to all kinds of lengths to help me find books that weren't easy to get hold of. I was very lucky, for example, when I managed to get in touch with the Burundian writer Marie-Thérèse Toyi, and someone who went to school with her told me that she'd written a book in English, which I was really keen to get hold of because, as far as I could find, there were only books in French from Burundi. And she amazingly couriered me a copy of her novel, Weep Not Refugee, from Nigeria and sent me a message wishing me good luck in my quest. But there were people who went even further than that. Julia Dewani was one example. She is a writer in South Sudan. Now, South Sudan is the world's newest country. It only got going in July 2011, which was a handful of months before I started my crazy quest. And it had come out of a massive civil war and had huge challenges to overcome. There weren't roads, there weren't hospitals, and I was pretty sure there weren't publishers really doing much work there. And she wrote me a story specially for my blog, and I launched the blog with her story, with her reading it. In fact, it was the enthusiasm of people and their interest in what I was doing that kept me going all through that year. Reading 4 books a week, or as it worked out to one book every 1.87 days, and writing blog posts, and then doing all the research to find the books and check out people's suggestions, was almost a full-time job. Except that I was already working full time, so it actually was quite tough trying to fit it all in. Reading the stories is an extraordinary experience, and what it makes you realise when you read so many books from so many different places is the amazing power that literature has to take you out of yourself and to see the world through the eyes of other people. It taught me, in the words of a novel that I read from Qatar by a writer called Abdulaziz Al Mahmoud, a book called The Corsair, which is actually one of the first Qatari novels to make it into English, that you would think differently if this land were your land and if these people were your people.
Writer Anne Morgan telling us about her project, reading one book from every country in the world. Check out her reading list and watch a great time-lapse video of how her book collection grew over the course of the year-long project. That's all at PRI.org. This is PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead,
imagine a silly situation where a bunch of people sitting around with goods and services to trade with each other, yet they're not because they don't have money. It sounds insane, right? It's dumb.
One community in Kenya came up with a solution: make its own money. Plus, a stylish alternative to the bike helmet from Sweden. Those stories coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The Pink Star, the world's largest pink diamond, went up for auction today in Geneva. Sotheby's says it went for a world record $83 million. Wow. Few people have even held the Pink Star in their hands, but one who has is John Hadelberg. He's a conceptual gem artist in New York who makes legal counterfeits of diamonds for companies like De Beers. I asked John to explain what makes the Pink Star so valuable.
Well, there's nothing in history like this particular diamond. Historically, the finest colored diamonds in the world came from India in the 1600s, but 12 years ago or so, when the diamond was unearthed by De Beers, They found this 132-carat crystal, and nothing like it had ever been discovered that had the potential to not only be flawless, but have a vivid pink color.
And so when that diamond comes out of the mine, you see its roughness, but you know that somewhere in there is a beauty waiting to be cut.
Well, you hope there is. I mean, it's a combination of science and art and physical and optical properties, but they found a 132-carat crystal, and they could have hoped that they would create a flawless diamond from it, but to attain a pink like this was something that no one really had any idea they could really achieve until the cutting was complete.
And John, you've held this pink star. You've had it in your hand. How much does it weigh? What does it look like?
Well, it's an incredible experience. It was, I think, exactly 10 years ago, and I first held the pink star in the inner vault of the Smithsonian. And I have to tell you that, for me, these gems are such wonders of the world. My reaction was, frankly, that I thought I could see all the way to Pluto when I held it.
Wow. You almost sounded on the verge of tears there for a second.
Well, these diamonds in this very significant small category, such as the Pink Star, the Hope Diamond, or the Dresden Dream, or the Centenary Diamond, are such rare objects. They're certainly wonders of the world. But the Pink Star is a great example of it could only become a wonder of the world, really, with the artistry of, in this case, the men who cut it. When they cut the Pink Star, it took them about 20 months. And what these cutters did, and I could not have cut the original Pink Star. There's only probably three men here in New York are able to do it. And only because of their genius were they able to achieve what's called in the trade the fancy vivid pink color.
So you had it in your hand. Was there heft to it? I mean, did it weigh like a lot for a diamond?
It's not really so much the heft, but diamonds, I believe, are perfectly designed containers for meaning. And again, in part because of the optics of it. In a very primitive level, people are attracted to them. The way the light refracts, they can get lost inside it as if it's a crystal ball.
Does that experience happen with you from time to time?
Oh, often, always. I can talk about the optics of diamonds at length. But with the pink star, certainly, again, a primitive aspect of it is that size does matter. And so, although it's not the heft, but the fact that when you're staring into the pink diamond, and the last time I saw it was a week ago at Sotheby's, you do become transfixed. And I really didn't want to leave its gaze. I felt I was looking at it, and it was looking at me.
Well, diamonds do connote romance, but I would say that this pink star probably has very little in common with the average engagement ring.
Well, the average engagement ring is very powerful. Every day, as you said, I am a conceptual gem artist, and every day I turn to the power that an engagement ring has and try to bring that to my other work. But the pink star is phenomenal. There is nothing like it in history.
John Hattelberg, he's a conceptual gem artist in New York. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
So a diamond from Africa sells for tens of millions of dollars. And for our next story, a community in Africa that's got a different sort of wealth. But this poor community in Kenya had a problem. It had lots to sell, but no money to buy anything. Its economy was at a standstill because there was no cash. So an American economist proposed a radical solution. Valerie Hamilton has our story.
Every picture you've ever seen of an African slum, that's this place. It's called Bangladesh, but it's outside of Mombasa on Kenya's coast. Dirt roads packed hard by bare feet, open sewers running next to them filled with trash. The main road is lined with blocks and blocks of tin-roofed sheds with tiny businesses inside. Everybody here is an entrepreneur just to survive.
Me, I have a tomato or cabbages business.
Emma Onyango sells vegetables from a little wooden stall. Other people sell fish or cornmeal. The mayor repairs clothes on an ancient sewing machine. The community is really poor, and so while everyone is selling something, very few people have cash to buy anything.
Imagine a silly situation where a bunch of people are sitting around with goods and services to trade with each other, yet they're not because they don't have money. It sounds insane, right? Well, it is insane. It's dumb.
Economist Will Ruddick is American, but he lives in Mombasa. He got together last year with a group of local business people and started asking some pretty revolutionary questions.
What is this thing that's called money that they need so that they're not poor? So can we replace that with something that they can use on a daily basis?
Their answer was to print a kind of paper voucher that people could use instead of cash for their local trade. More than 100 business people signed up to use it, like a microcredit loan, but backed by the faith and credit of the community, not the bank. They named it Bangla Pesa, after the name of the slum and the Swahili word for money.
Hey, yeah, Bangla Pesa.
A Bangla Pesa is something like an IOU, except that it represents goods throughout the local economy rather than a one-on-one debt. Say you pay Emma 20 Bangla Pesa for her tomatoes. She can then get 20 Bangla Pesas worth of anything she wants that's for sale in the Bangla Pesa system, no cash required. That lets her save her Kenyan cash for things outside the local economy, things like bus fare and school fees.
We never had any savings, but after discovering Bangla Pesa, our Kenya money, we could even put them somewhere. Our children could be going to school.
When the people here started using the vouchers in May, everyone suddenly had more resources to spend. Will Ruddick says trade jumped 22% in the first week.
And it was about 3 weeks after that that the police decided that it was a forgery.
It started with articles in the local paper that implied Bangla Pesa was part of a secessionist movement with shady links to Islamic terrorists. You can imagine what happened next.
First, they came into the community and started rounding people up.
We were threatened, don't use this money, it is bad money.
The police were running around asking people, you know, whose door to knock down and, you know, who's abetting the terrorists and that sort of thing.
Our names, we were just like people who had killed somebody, who had done something which had not been done.
Kenyan police threw Ruddick Onyango and four other community leaders in jail and charged them with bank fraud. They faced up to 7 years.
The six denied the charges and were released on bail.
Now, although this was news in Kenya, it wasn't the first time something like this had happened. Currency experiments like Bangla Pesa have ended up in court in Thailand and Brazil, too, and they've won. Ruddick spent the summer fighting the charges with a public education campaign. Here's a video he produced on YouTube.
With Bangla Pesa flowing through the community, trade increases and the market stabilizes.
An international conference of complementary currencies at The Hague circulated a petition in support of Bangla Pesa. More than 600 people signed it. After 4 months, Kenya's public prosecutor finally dropped the charges. Since then, it's taken a few weeks to convince people in the slum that it's safe to use Bangla Pesa again.
We are really frustrated because business is down.
The community had to pay to print new vouchers with holograms and security seals. But this month, Bangla Pesa are going back into circulation. This time, Ruddick says, the local government is invited to celebrate the launch. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Mombasa, Kenya.
You've probably seen this next item making the rounds on the internet. It's an invention that could change the way you and I ride a bike. An invisible bike helmet. Therese Hovding came up with the idea as part of her master's thesis in Sweden. Therese, how can a bike helmet, first of all, actually be invisible?
Oh, yeah, that was a tricky part to solve.
I'll bet.
It started out with us talking to a lot of cyclists about why they're not using conventional cycle helmets. And they were all asking for something really discreet and something preferably invisible and something that would not destroy their personal style or their hair, for that matter. So that's how we started thinking about, is it possible to develop a cycle helmet that is not placed on your head at all, but instead it would be around your neck.
Right. So what'd you come up with?
The invention is a collar with an airbag system inside. The airbag is folded up inside the collar, so you don't actually have anything on top of your head until you end up in an accident, and then the airbag is triggered to inflate in a tenth of a second around your head.
So you wear this collar and the helmet airbag thing is kind of stuffed into it. How does the collar attach to your clothes?
No, it's not attached to your clothes. You put the collar around your neck and then there's a zip at the front of the collar that you zip it up. And then there's also an on-off button that you need to activate the system with. So you push the on-off button and then you will hear a sound signal that says doot-loot-doot. And then you know that it's on.
Have you personally tested the airbag helmet and crashed with it to see what it's like?
I've tested it many, many times, of course. I've actually not crashed it myself, although my co-founder, Anna, she was in a crash just a few weeks ago and had the collar on and it inflated.
What was that like?
Well, most people who are in crashes, it's really a scary situation to be in. You get really scared. It happens so very quickly. So they don't really realize until after the accident that the airbag is inflated around their head. But to describe how it feels, it goes so quickly. It's up in a tenth of a second. And when the pressure is on, it's stiff like a football almost. So it just goes really quickly and suddenly it's there around your head. And then after the accident, it slowly starts to deflate again.
So anyone here in the U.S. who's got a bicycle and a bicycle helmet knows that inside the helmet there's that Department of Transportation approved sticker. Has the Swedish government approved this?
Yes. In order to sell a bicycle helmet within Europe, you need a CE marking. So it has gone through a massive testing procedure.
Will you be marketing this in the U.S. and have you started to go through the approval process here?
No, we have not started with the U.S. introduction. That is a bit further down the road. I think for now we have enough to handle with the European market. We just need to take everything one step at a time. And coming up next is actually the Japanese market.
All right. So, Therese, here comes the real bitter pill. How much does this invisible helmet cost?
It costs €399. Right,
it's about $500.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, it's more expensive than conventional helmets. Because it's airbag technology, it's very advanced technology. It's not easy and cheap to produce. So that's why there needs to be a higher price. And of course, you always have the possibility to choose a conventional helmet if that's what you prefer.
What if you hit a bump or something? Is there any accidental way the helmet could be deployed?
Oh, when it's not supposed to?
Yeah.
No, that is what we have been working so hard. I mean, the biggest challenge technically for us in the development was to get it right, to get the trigger function right, completely accurate in when to inflate and when not to inflate. And in order to get that right, we have been using test cyclists who have been wearing the collar in their everyday life, collecting data on how their body moves. We've had to simulate all known cycling accidents and then develop a mathematical method that can distinguish those two, separate those two categories of body movements.
That's impressive. Are you wearing your own product? Are you wearing this invisible helmet now?
Oh, yeah. I would never go cycling anywhere without it. I know too much about what can go wrong in cycling accidents. So I know everything about how you can get seriously injured from just a minor crash. And I would not wear any other protection.
Designer Therese Hovding in Malmö, Sweden. Thanks very much and best of luck with this new invention.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You'll definitely want to see that invisible helmet in action. We've got video at PRI.org. And here's another story about innovations you can use to impress your friends. Vancouver is hoping to become the greenest city in the world by 2020. Just yesterday, they moved a step closer, becoming the first North American municipality to launch a recycling program for cigarette butts. Albie Zakes is with TerraCycle, the company handling the program.
We'll be setting up 110 public recycling receptacles, what would look like an ashtray, but instead of cigarette butts going to landfill, they'll actually be recycled into plastic industrial products, such as shipping pallets and plastic lumber.
Can I ask a very basic question? How do you get the stink out?
So that's a great question. We take the cigarette butts, we melt them down, and then we pelletize them. Through that process, not only is the smell removed, but also any toxins or carcinogens, so that end plastic is completely safe.
But wait, you say, cigarette butts are made of fiber, not plastic, right?
It's a common misconception that a cigarette butt is actually made of a fiber, when in fact it's made out of cellulose acetate, which is a plastic product that's made to look like a fiber. So in case you were wondering, cigarettes are very unhealthy.
There, you heard it here first or second. Oh, and if you can't make it to Vancouver, Zake says his company will take your butts in the mail. Seriously. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Nail-biting time for many soccer fans out there. It's the World Cup playoffs, which means over the next week, national teams will do battle to try and snag one of the few remaining tickets to next year's World Cup in Brazil. The smallest nation with a dog still in this fight is Iceland. They're up against Croatia. Now, Iceland has a very small population and a small stable of professional players to choose from. And yet, there they are, with a chance, however slim, of making it to Rio. That's more than Ireland can boast. The Irish national team has already been eliminated, and most Irish fans are already looking well beyond Rio. But not Owen Conlon. Over beers with a Brazilian co-worker in Dublin recently, Conlon started wondering out loud about throwing his support behind Iceland.
And we just sort of laughed that like it's the closest Ireland's going to get to go under Brazil.
Conlon and his friend work for a digital design firm, and so they did what comes naturally. They built a website in support of Iceland's soccer team. Then they started up a Twitter feed and started urging Irish soccer fans to back Iceland. The campaign is called County Iceland. Ireland already has 32 counties, so Conlon says, why not make Iceland the 33rd?
There's only like 320,000 people in Iceland, so if they were a county in Ireland, I'm calling them the 33rd county. They'd only be the fifth largest county in Ireland. Like, it's incredible, like, the success they've had. And hopefully they continue it.
Conlon says the website is just a bit of fun. All a visitor has to do is click a support button. The site also introduces Irish fans to the Iceland lineup, although they've added a few O's here and there, so that, you know, for example, Icelandic forward Gudjonsson is now O Gudjonsson. Conlon's also conveniently changed some of the traditional Irish soccer chants to make them Iceland-friendly. He says some people are questioning his Irish patriotism, but for the most part, everyone's taking it in the spirit it was intended, as a bit of fun, and a way to forget about Ireland's failed qualifying campaign. Although Conlon does admit to having something of an ongoing love affair with the Icelandic soccer team.
My relationship with Iceland starts many years ago. My first international match was Ireland-Iceland. Finished 0-0. It was a terrible match. So I think that's when the story of Owen and Iceland begins. And there was around a 15-year hiatus, but now we're back together.
Isn't that sweet? The County Iceland site's only been live since Sunday, but already more than 10,000 visitors have become supporters. Conlon says he can't believe the site's gotten this much attention, but now he says why not try to get as many supporters on the site as Iceland has people. He notes that if Iceland does manage to beat Croatia, it will become the least populous nation to ever qualify for a World Cup. Previous record holder, Trinidad and Tobago. So, what's left to say, but...
go on, Iceland!
Conlon also admits that Icelanders find his website pretty darn weird. But hey, given how few of them there are, they'll probably take all the support they can get. You can check out some of Conlon's Iceland-friendly soccer chants at PRI.org. That right there, that's the sound of student participation. It's a beat created by one of the students in the beat-making lab. We've been chatting regularly with lab co-founders Pierce Freelon and Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Apple Juice Kid. They're usually in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where they teach music at UNC, but this week they're in Ethiopia, where the latest lab participants are learning how to produce the fundamental beats of hip-hop.
We've done a few presentations already. We had a big performance yesterday at the African Union. So it's been a really high-intensity couple days here in Ethiopia.
Have you had any aha moments since you got there? I mean, it seems previously that when you spoke in some of the kids, it wasn't really sure from the videos that we saw whether things were sticking. I mean, going back, are people coming up to you and saying, I really get this now?
Yeah, I mean, we just had a long morning with one of our students, Ifa. I got a chance to hear his beats for the first time. And it was really interesting just immediately hearing the stuff that he's been doing. Actually, Ifa just walked in the room as we're speaking.
Yeah.
Say hello, Ifa.
Hey.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was immediate reaction, like, oh, this is awesome. And, oh, I can't believe you did that. Like, don't work from just the template. You know, it sounds just like everyone else. And, yeah, there was, like, immediate, you know, teaching moments, but also just a real proud sense that it has stuck and he has continued to make music and
teach others,
yeah,
too.
One of the students we've been tracking with you is a young woman named Galila. Here's a clip from your video where we were first introduced to Galila.
My name is Galila. I live in Addis. I'm 21 years old. And I
like music, so I would like to be a beat maker.
So, Pearson, Stephen, that was Galila at the beginning of this lab process. Where is she at now?
We saw her yesterday, hung out with her all day. She was really exhausted because she is in school and works a full-time job. But, you know, she's really interested and passionate about continuing to work with the Beatmaking Lab and finding ways to, you know, expand and get more involved. Last night, we were on stage, I mentioned, at the African Union with Galila. You know, Applejuice is DJing with five Ethiopian drummers, and she got up on stage and did an impromptu rendition of Bob Marley's Three Little Birds. She loves music still, and she's interested in, and you know, continuing to grow with the program here.
I'll also add one thing that Pierce keeps referring to the African Union. It's actually a part of a conference that we're attending with IntraHealth called the International Conference on Family Planning, and last night was the opening night at the African Union, and we were asked to perform. It was an amazing opening to this conference. We were kind of the entertaining, interesting part to a bunch of speeches that came before us, which I'm sure were interesting.
Not that they were boring or anything, but, you know, so we're the beat makers, so we get to have more fun than everybody else.
I did sample Melinda Gates' voice in the DJ set. I think that might be the, you know, the twist that everyone liked.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you call it entertainment, but as you were performing for these development professionals, do you think they were making the connection that, you know, hip-hop can deliver a message that maybe they've been struggling for decades to deliver?
There's nothing like watching people react to hip-hop music. Embracing family planning, which is the goal of this conference, it's really a youth initiative. When we're talking about the hip-hop generation, the people that didn't grow up with hip-hop aren't starting families right now. So if you want to get with young people and kind of get with the program, you need to get with the language that they speak. And I think musically, culturally, that's hip-hop.
Well, Stephen and Pierce, it's been terrific following you guys and your students in Addis and what they've done. I'd like us to go out with another dose of that amazing beat we heard a bit of last week, the finished product from the lab in Addis. This is a track called Des Yalal. And before you guys go, tell us what Des Yalal means.
Yeah, Des Yalal means feels good. So I hope it feels good, y'all.
Thanks so much for being with us for the last few weeks. Beatmaking Lab co-founders Pierce Freelon and Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Applejuice Kid. Enjoy the rest of your time in Addis.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Find more from the folks at the Beatmaking Lab, including their great videos, at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.